Welcome to the good old days. I'm Jerome Manigan. I have stories for you from the October 2006 issue of the good old days magazine. We're starting today's program with Mickey Mouse Club. It's written by Gene Paffert Glasgow. I'm the guy they call Mr. Mickey Mouse. Got a sweetie down in the chicken house, neither fat nor skinny. She's the horse's Winnie. She's my little Mickey Mouse. We sang this song every Saturday morning when we went to the Mickey Mouse Club at the Fox Theater. To lead us as we sang, a ball bounced over the words that were projected onto the movie screen. The song was Minnie's Yahoo, and the most fun was shouting a loud Yahoo at the end. During the 1930s, I often stood in line at the box office waiting to buy a ticket. When my turn came, I carefully untied the knot in my handkerchief that was keeping my nickel safe. I handed my money to the cashier and clutched the ticket she gave me in return. With my little friends, I eagerly hurried through the doors in the luxurious lobby into the big, beautiful theater to find a seat. We waved and chattered excitedly until Mrs. Weedock, the leader of the Mickey Mouse Club, came on stage and spoke into a microphone. "Children, please stand, face the flag on the stage, and recite the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag of the United States of America." I placed my right hand over my heart and recited the pledge in unison with the other children. We sang America, following the words on the screen, and then our favorite, Minnie's Yahoo. Then we sat down and listened to announcements. These usually were followed by special entertainment, sometimes talent shows and live acts. Once Monte Montana twirled his rope on stage while on his horse. Next, the theater was darkened and cartoons were shown. We loved the Bugs Bunny, Donald Duck, and Mickey Mouse cartoons. Our laughter resounded throughout the theater. An exciting serial followed, featuring episodes of Flash Gordon or The Long Ranger. Then a movie suitable for children was shown. When I was 8 years old, I won a contest at the theater. My mother had collected coupons for the contest with the help of her friends. Since she collected more than anyone else, I was the winner. When my name was called, I walked up the steps on the right side of the stage by the Wurlitzer organ. With all eyes on me, I was nervous. A girl was following me. She was the runner-up. Mrs. Weedock greeted me and led me to a table where two prizes were displayed. One was a big, beautiful doll with curly blonde hair wearing a party dress. The other prize was a 14-inch Mickey Mouse doll dressed in long red pants, a black top, and yellow gloves. When she told me that I could choose my prize, I chose the Mickey Mouse doll without hesitation. I will never forget how upset my mother was. "Jean, why didn't you choose the pretty baby doll? She had put so much effort into collecting coupons so that I could win." I didn't have an answer for her then, but I loved that Mickey Mouse doll. When my friends and I were students at Tucson High School, the Fox Theater was a favorite place to go on a date. It was cooled with refrigeration, a novelty in those days, and so it was a great place for escaping the heat of Tucson summers. Uniformed ushers carrying small flashlights showed us to our seats. Usually we sat on the main floor, but once in a while we splurged and sat upstairs in the lounge in those comfortable plush seats. There was no snack bars in the theater. We couldn't have dreamed of eating inside that beautiful theater. Instead, after the movie, we headed across Stone Avenue to Litz Drugstore for soft drinks, milkshakes, or hamburgers. It was a sad day in 1974 when the theater closed. It stood vacant and run down for many years until funds were raised to restore it. I can hardly wait to see it restored to its former splendor. But I doubt that there will ever again be a Mickey Mouse Club at the Fox Theater. That part of its history will live only in the memories of those who were members of the club, as I was. I still have my blue membership card, number 3683. Mickey Mouse Club was written by Gene Patford Glasgow. Turning elsewhere, in the October 2006 issue of the Good Old Days magazine to Those Hard Girls and Guys. It's written by Doris Markland. When we ladies in our 80s are out for lunch, we often talk about the days when we were girls in the 30s. That's 1930s. Those are the memories coming in clearly now, as our short-term memory sometimes falters with names and dates and what we had for breakfast. The subject of hired girls came up recently. My friends who had grown up in large cities were amazed. You mean you had a living maid? Wow, your folks must have been rich. Well, no, I said. It wasn't quite like that. I exchanged smiles with other country girls at our table who might have grown up in different states but had lived on a farm. Then, in order to explain, I made a quick mental trip back to those times to remember myself just what it was like. In our small community of Stanhope, Iowa, we never had a hired girl all the time, although we could have used one. In the fall, my mother rose early, fired up the iron range, put oatmeal at the back to cook slowly, and then went to the barn to help milk the cows. Later, when she'd seen us off in the school bus, she went to the field with Dad and did a man's job all day before coming home to cook dinner. In the spring, there was the field planting, the garden planting, and the complete house cleaning. When they finally could afford it, she might have called in some help for that. But she really needed help in the summer and early fall when the fruits and vegetables were harvested and canned, and when the neighborhood threshing crew descended on the farm and enormous meals had to be prepared. And then came the fall house cleaning. The hired girl might be the daughter of a friend, relative, or neighbor, or she might be a girl from a neighboring town who had passed the word that she was looking for work. Often it was a girl from a large family who was no longer needed at home and who was saving up for school or marriage. I can't say for sure, but I think she worked for about $2 to $5 a week plus room and board. Dad had a hired man for the heavy seasons and sometimes one who stayed on beyond that. It might be the young son of a neighbor, or it might be a grown man who wandered the country looking for work. One of the latter was Shorty. He was short, but he was strong and held up his end of the work. After supper, he sat on the porch and played his guitar. The folks felt safe leaving us kids with him while they went to town. He told us stories he was reading in his Western pulp magazines. Another hired man was a really big guy named Donnie who laughed a lot. I remember him especially for one reason. He put sugar on his potatoes and gravy. Kids notice things like that. One of our hired girls went out with a beau some evenings, and she went back to her home on weekends. During the week, she had one of our upstairs bedrooms, and she allowed me to come in and look at her things. I was fascinated by everything on that bureau. Her brush and hand mirror had inset pictures of elegant ladies. There was a bottle of Green Wave set and a box of long silver clamps to help her crimp her hair into waves. There was Lady Esther or Pond's Cold Cream and another jar called Vanishing Cream. But the lipsticks, they were the best. She let me try out the bright and dark reds. Then she showed me how to send a coupon from a magazine to receive my own small sample of Tangy lipstick. When it arrived in the mail, I felt that I had grown inches overnight, my first lipstick. It looked to be a light orange, but on my lips it became a very pale natural pink. To this day, I can close my eyes and taste it. In my memories, I see the hired girl working side by side with my mother, paring apples, snapping green beans, stirring jellies, hanging huge baskets of sheets and clothes on the line, scrubbing down walls and pounding carpet. And of course, when the threshing crew came, mother and her helper worked as a team, making pies in the early morning, putting roast in the oven, baking bread, and making salads. They set up washstands with clean towels outside the door and long tables inside to feed the hungry workmen. As we children grew and took over our share of the work, we seldom needed a hired girl. But as my parents prospered, paid off the mortgage, and added another 80, my dad had even more need for a hired hand. The last one he hired was a bright young man who stayed on, married, and lived in the house my dad brought onto the property for him. Soon little children were running about the place again. We later went to the weddings of our hired girls, and they brought their firstborn to show us. But living maids, hardly. They, like the hired men, were family. Those Hired Girls and Guys was written by Doris Markland. Turning to Pie Suppers and Christmas Programs, it's by Doris Matlock. The small country school of White Oak was situated about 17 miles southeast of Tahlequah, Oklahoma, in Cherokee County. In the 1930s and 1940s, the annual pie suppers and Christmas program that were held there were the highlights of our farm community's social calendar. In late October and early November, two pie suppers were held to raise money for Christmas gifts for the school children. All the ladies brought pies, beautifully wrapped in bright paper, to be auctioned off to the highest bidder. The name of each baker was discreetly pinned to the paper. Teenage girls hoped that their boyfriend would buy their pies so that they could eat together. The men bought their wives' pies. We enjoyed other entertaining events after the pies were sold. For the cakewalk, a large circle of chalk squares was drawn on the wooden floor. Each square was numbered. Individuals and couples who had bought tickets started walking around the circle as music was played on a wind-up record player. A number was called out, and when the music stopped, whoever was standing on that number won a cake. After that, a jar of dill pickles was ready for the lovesick couple, teenagers who were sweet on each other. These couples were nominated by someone putting down money to have their names written on the chalkboard. A time limit was set, and the couple who made the most money would have to come to the front of the room and together take a bite from a pickle held by an auctioneer. The embarrassed couple endured much clapping and laughter from the audience, but it was all in fun and good humor. Next was the pretty girl cake. Girls' names were written on the chalkboard, and the girl who got the most votes, backed by money, got the cake. Finally, a bar of soap, usually homemade lye soap, was ready for the man with the dirtiest feet. Names were put on the chalkboard, and again the man who got the most votes and the most money had to come to the front of the room, take off a boot, and hold up his foot for all to see and smell. Finally, the men and older boys paid for their pies, looked at the name of the maker, found her, and had a piece of pie together. While all this was going on, all the money was tallied and the total was posted on the board for all to see before we headed home. A good time was had by all. One of the most joyous Christmas programs was made possible by these pie suppers. It was held a few days before Christmas, and the whole community participated. We began planning in November. The teacher decided which names would be in the play and who would give individual speeches. The bashful ones were given small parts and coached gently by the older students. The welcome speech was a rousing one given by a brave student who could deliver with a clear, confident voice. We had no microphones in those days. During the last hour of the school day, the teacher would give us time to work on memorizing our parts. Our one big room was decorated with red paper bells strung from high on one wall to the other side. Green and silver crepe paper ropes crisscrossed just below the ceiling, and colorful paper chains made by the students decorated the windows. Two large Christmas wreaths were hung on either side of the curtains. The curtains were large white sheets hung on wires stretched across the front of the stage. A few days before the program, a couple of the dads and some of the bigger boys would bring in a big cedar tree nailed to a stand and put it in one corner of the room by the stage. The teacher and older girls would decorate it while the rest of us were out playing at recess. I remember so well the fragrance of the tree and how festive and bright the whole room was. The tree had lots of ornaments and sparkling icicles. Then, on the night of the program, more good smells came from the big boxes of fruit, candy, and presents under the tree. The program was held on a Friday night. Our lighting was provided by gasoline lanterns. All the parents and grandparents came to see their children say their pieces and perform their parts in the play, which was usually a humorous one. At the end of the program, the spotlight was on the nativity scene with the appropriate actors, and the Christmas story was read from Luke's Gospel. Then came the moment all the kids had been waiting for, getting their presents from under the tree. Suddenly, Santa would appear through the north door from behind the Christmas tree with shouts of, "Ho, ho, ho, Merry Christmas!" He would help hand out gifts and talk to the little ones, and especially the ones on their mama's lap. There was lots of happy noise from the laughter and rustling of paper. Each family received a sack of fruit, nuts, and candy. This community project provided a very happy time for our small farm community and made for a very joyous and memorable Christmas in the good old days. And we're turning to How Polio Changed My Life. It's by Donna Henai. I was looking forward to a full, enjoyable early October weekend. There was a high school football game Friday night against rival Boulder High School. A festive birthday weekend was going to be held, with my mother, brother, and father all having birthdays in a row. The spirited football game was exciting on that crisp autumn evening. I did my share of jumping and cheering. But by the end of the evening, I noticed that my back ached continually. The next day, there were preparations for the party that night. My sister-in-law was hosting the event. By evening, I felt quite ill, and for most of the party, I rested on their bed. I was extremely sick all night with severe headache, neck ache, chills, and fever. I could sense my parents' concern the next morning. There were several telephone calls to doctors, and arrangements were made for a doctor to meet us at Longmont Hospital that quiet Sunday morning. The doctor walked into the exam room and told me to touch my chin to my chest. I could not do so without much pain. Much later, I learned that I had been fortunate that day, because the doctor who had seen me had just recovered from a mild case of polio himself, and he knew exactly what to check. I then had a spinal tap, which was not pleasant, but it confirmed the doctor's suspicions. I was rushed in an ambulance to Children's Hospital in Denver. I know my parents were terrified. I sensed their worry about polio, but I did not know what to expect. I was too sick to think about it. The next 2 weeks in isolation were endless. I was in a partitioned, nearly dark room with the door closed, and I was told that I should stay on my back with my feet against a board at the base of the bed. The doctors and nurses came in each day and checked on me, but they didn't stay long, and they didn't have much to say. One day I was finally told that they would be moving me by way of a tunnel under the street to the girls' polio ward. Now I was excited. There were 15 to 20 girls in the L-shaped ward. Two girls were from Longmont, my hometown. Elaine was 16 and Diane was 7 or 8, but I hadn't known them before. There were highs and lows in the following 3 months. I was troubled that I did not go to therapy as others did, but I had to continue lying flat for weeks. I learned to look forward to the hot packs twice a day. A nurse with a machine with very hot water and a wringer would come and squeeze out a towel and spread it on my body for about 15 minutes. It felt so good. On warm, sunny days, a nurse would push our hospital beds out onto a roof to take in the fresh air and sunshine. My parents were the only visitors I could have 3 times a week, and thank goodness for that. I did get many cards and greetings, which always lifted my spirits. I experienced highs and lows when nurses brought children in iron lungs through our ward. The iron lung was a large machine and looked somewhat like one of today's MRI machines. The machine forced the patient to breathe. There was a mirror attached to each machine above the patient's face. The patients lay flat on their backs and could not turn their heads, but I could see their smiles in the mirror. I did not ever see the boys' ward. There was much talk one Sunday about a football player who had been brought in on Friday night. After what seemed like many weeks, I was finally taken down to the pool for therapy. Eventually, I learned to walk again. By this time, I no longer had hot packs each day. My parents' faces were brighter. Dr. Hopley was invited to go duck hunting on our farm, and he had better news for them each time they saw him. I learned later that there were two schools of thought about treatment for polio in 1952, one of the years of the polio epidemic. Some believed that therapy should begin very soon after diagnosis. Others, like my doctor, believed rest and heat were best. Although each case is different, I was told when I left the hospital that I was one of only 4 who could walk out on their own that year. I recall walking haltingly out of the hospital with my parents. After going home, there were weeks of therapy which took place on our kitchen table. For a time, the school district furnished a tutor for me at home. She seemed very elderly and could not teach Latin, which was one of my favorite courses. Eventually, in the spring, I returned to school. I had to walk upstairs one at a time, and my right arm was in a sling. My friends had all changed and grown up, and I had a major adjustment finding new friends. The two girls from Longmont were both in heavy braces. Several years later, I went to Elaine's wedding, and with much assistance, she was able to walk down the aisle. Diane, the younger girl, was able to eventually get out of her braces. At times, I can still see the warm, kind faces of the doctor and nurses who cared for me. I still visualize the vivid blue Colorado sky we saw on the days on the roof over the Denver traffic below. Nor will I forget the songs Ellen would sing now and then. The Jane Froment movie had come out recently, and she would sing songs from the movie. She was a vocalist in our high school choir. As for myself, I have several dead muscles throughout my body, but have managed very well. How Polio Changed My Life was written by Donna Hynai. And we're going to end today's program with this by Lorna Metzka. I meet God in the morning when my day is at its best, and his presence comes like sunshine, like a glory in my breast. All day long his presence lingers, all day long he stays with me, and we sail in perfect calmness over a troubled sea. So I think I've learned the secret, learned from many a troubled way. You must see him in the morning if you need him through the day. My Day with God was written by Lorna Meska. And with that, we're at the end of today's edition of The Good Old Days. I'm Jerome Manigan, inviting you to join me again next week, same place, same time, for another journey back in time to the good old days. Bye-bye. The Good Old Days was recorded in the studios of Radio Reading Services, WRRS, the voice of information, by Robin Clemens.